Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. We have an interesting show ahead of us, featuring later in the show a visit with Edna Clinton, president of the local NAACP chapter, and Commander Jeff Huff of the Ames Police, about meetings these two organizations have been holding to educate each other on how to stay safe, stay within the law, and respect one another. And we have a few updates on Story County government from our correspondent there, Leanne Harter, who was not able to be with us this morning. We begin the show with a story that has its continuation at the Pizza Ranch in Story City at 8:30 a.m. today, Monday, when lawyers from the Midwest Corn Lawsuit address farmers and other members of the agricultural community about the opportunity to join in the lawsuit. As my next guest explains, this lawsuit is not a class action lawsuit, but rather a mass action lawsuit. It all begins with the agribusiness Syngenta and their GMO seed AgriSure VipTerra, that's V-I-P, Terra, which they released to market several years ago. Here's Sean Fagan, a lawyer from Indiana who is gathering plaintiffs for this suit against Syngenta.
Syngenta, which is a large agribusiness company, and most farmers, if not all, know their products, know of their seed. It's Syngenta created a GMO seed for release in the United States called AgriSure VipTerra. Now, in order to release the seed into the United States, they had to do this a long process and condition set by the USDA. So in order to release this corn into the U.S., they needed to set up a certain education program for farmers to segregate it from export lines from the United States. All these conditions were necessary in order for Syngenta to release this into the U.S. Syngenta promised that they would do this, and they were then granted access to the U.S. market for AgriSure VipTerra.
So Syngenta went through the application process to get their seed approved through the USDA, yes. And part of the stipulation was that they conduct a farmer education program, and a major part of that program is to ensure that farmers do not direct their seed toward an export line because other countries don't accept GMOs.
Right, and if not just that they don't accept them, they have their own regulatory process. And this was the case with China. Now, with dealing with China, Syngenta had submitted the VipTerra to the Chinese government in around 2010, and ultimately China approved VipTerra for use in 2014, toward the end of 2014, early 2015. However, during the span of that 4 years, Syngenta was recommending to farmers, hey, you should plant this seed because China will be approving this any day now, and there's even instances for other cases and evidence suggesting that Syngenta was making these representations to farmers to encourage them to grow this seed, knowing that most likely these bushels would be exported over to China, and although these exports would be going to China, China at the time had not approved this certain seed for entry into the country.
So when a farmer goes to market, does he have to kind of tell the people there at the co-op, this is the type of corn that I planted?
Well, there are a number of issues with that. One would be dealing with the grain elevators. For instance, what brought all these documents to the fore was a lawsuit a number of years ago between Bunge and Syngenta. Bunge, knowing about VipTerra and the export limitations with China, they notified Syngenta and farmers saying, hey, we're going to segregate VipTerra. We're going to do it. No exportation of this. And Syngenta sued Bunge. And so you had all this information, such as Syngenta making these representations, hey, China is going to approve this any day now, and all these other things.
When you say Bunge, what is that? I'm sorry that I don't know what Bunge is.
Bunge is an international scale grain company. They operate elevators for shipment import-export. They're a major company on the level of Cargill and ADM.
Okay, so Bunge is saying to Syngenta, no, we're not going to take this type of corn because we know that China has not yet approved it. And Syngenta tries to sue them?
Yes, that lawsuit was the initiation of a whole process of these documents coming to light as Syngenta was trying to promote Viptera as an export corn without giving certain representations and the like.
Goodness. So it kind of came around to bite him in the you-know-what.
Well, it gets better.
Okay.
It gets better. Well, Syngenta is promoting this corn, saying China, China, China. They're going to approve it any day now. So unfortunately, as these things happen, some samples of Viptera got into exports bound for China. Well, at first, China just kept it on the quiet. They destroyed the shipment so as not to affect price and create ripples in the overall market. However, more samples of Viptera started showing up in China-bound exports from the United States. And so because of that, because of all these shipments of an unregulated import into the country, China just didn't just block these certain exports. They banned all U.S. corn imports in 2013-2014 because of Syngenta and this one strain of corn.
So now it's not just an issue with those farmers who grew the Viptera. It's now an issue with all corn farmers because their corn no longer has access to the China market.
During the years of 2013-2014, you are correct, and not just farmers who had nothing to do with Viptera. It's grain elevator operators because they had to deal with customers bringing less corn to them because of the drop in corn price per bushel. You had transporters. Basically, futures traders in Chicago heard of this action by China. They started to short corn futures. So over a two-month period, corn prices fell from around $7 to around $3, give or take, a loss of about 50%. And as you can imagine, that impacted many, many people in the agricultural economies.
So the plaintiffs that you represent go beyond farmers.
We're limiting our claims to farmers, transporters, grain elevator operators, those actually more involved within the infrastructure of corn transportation and corn production. These stakeholders were impacted in a direct way by the drop in the price in corn.
So how many people have signed on to this lawsuit?
Oh, tens of thousands. About 45,000 or more have signed up to sue Syngenta to bring claims against them. There are a few distinctions that need to be made. One, we're not doing a class action suit or a class action type of claim, where in a class action you have all these people together suing as one with one legal team. And so when you have a settlement or a judgment, the attorney's fees get split off from that main settlement to them, and then that whatever is left gets distributed equally to each party within that class. So if you have more people in the class, each person gets less. So what we're trying to do is called mass action. Mass torts are basically individual lawsuits where each person has their own individual claim. They're suing Syngenta on their own, but they're doing with a bunch of other people, tens of thousands of other people in this case, with the same general legal envelope or umbrella to represent them all in court, and especially in this case in Minnesota where Syngenta headquarters are. So we're doing that because it's fair that way. Each person gets money, or that the hope is when push comes to shove with settlement or a judgment, each person will get what is fair and relevant to their own claims, not just some token amount affected by legal fees. We're trying to do what's best for the individual claim and true to the circumstances that each person has.
Okay. You are touring the state of Iowa, talking to folks who are involved, who have signed up to be part of this lawsuit.
We want to send out invitations to all parties affected, members of the public, farmers, transporters, elevator operators. We're just trying to spread the word about what we're up to, what we're doing, how Syngenta has affected them, and trying to create awareness in order to help farmers. They won't recover everything, but we're just trying to give them options as to what they can do in order to mitigate the financial losses caused by Syngenta's actions.
Okay, so when you hold your meeting in Story City Monday morning at 8:30, you're hoping to see some people, some new faces who have heard about this and want to become involved because they recognize that they've had some losses and would like to recoup them through this lawsuit.
Yes, ma'am. We believe in strength in numbers and giving people awareness because knowledge is power. And while, you know, if people don't know what's going on, they can't help themselves, they can't avail themselves of the justice system in order to mitigate what happened to them. So we like to hold these open town hall meetings, especially at the Story City Pizza Ranch on Monday at 8:30. We want people to come and just hear and see what we're about. We want to connect, and if they have questions, we'll be happy to answer them. If they don't have questions, and just want to have a good time of fellowship, that's great, too.
And a lawyer, Sean Fagan, says that these meetings, such as the one in Story City, are just the first in a three-step process. First, establishing the lawyer-client relationship, signing people up, as it were. Second, obtaining from the clients the documentation of their losses, the elevator receipts, seed receipts, and so on. And finally, he and his colleagues at Moore, Archer & Associates, a law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., Texas, and Des Moines, will file the lawsuit in Minnesota, where Syngenta has its headquarters. Of course, Syngenta also has a large facility here in central Iowa in eastern Boone County. I asked Mr. Fagan what kind of money is involved here.
We're looking at damages in the billions. I mean, trade advocacy groups in the United States have estimated losses in 2013 at $2.9 billion, and you can expect that to go higher for 2014 and proportionally in 2015. So we're talking billions of dollars of potential losses.
And as for you, your law firm, is this a speculative type of venture thus far, or do you have the backing of an organization at this point to help you pay for your time in, you know, establishing the clientele and so forth?
Well, I can tell you this. We've agreed with Syngenta. We've agreed with the court that any settlement that comes down the road between Syngenta and all our clients, our many thousands of clients, 95% of all these plaintiffs are going to have to approve of this settlement. That means a very high threshold of acceptance of the terms, a high threshold of the matters and the facts of the deal. Now, if you have 95% of people agreeing on anything, that's great. That's a very high satisfaction rate. Now, because of that high threshold, we're expecting to get, when any settlement comes, it's going to be a good deal. It's going to be a good thing and fair and just for plaintiffs, for farmers, for transporters, for grain elevator operators. That is what motivates us to try to negotiate and fight for the best deal that we can for farmers.
I see. So it won't just be a matter of you reclaiming your exorbitant fees and then walking off with the farmers getting a couple of pennies for their trouble.
Actually, in a class action lawsuit situation, that would be the case. But our fee structure and the way we do things, the farmer is going to get a high percentage of any recovery. We're going to get our percentage. If we don't perform on the behalf of our client and we don't get funds for them, then we don't get paid.
Sean Fagan, do you have any background in farming?
No, but I can say I'm from a little town called Wanata, Indiana. And when I look out my back door, I see a cornfield. When I look to my right, I see another cornfield. When I look to my left, I see another cornfield. And in front of me, I see a bean field of soybeans. So in my section of Indiana, there's a lot of agricultural infrastructure, a lot of agricultural industry. And I joined onto this lawsuit with this legal because not only is this important to my own state of Indiana, farming, but farmers have been hit with all sorts of things, falling prices, you know, a depressed market. And if we can alleviate, if I can help alleviate in just one way against Syngenta and how their actions precipitated a large drop in corn prices over the last couple of years, then I'm happy and I can sleep well. And that makes me feel like I've done a good thing.
Okay. And again, this is a lawsuit against Syngenta because they misrepresented the viability of a variety of GMO corn that had not yet been approved in China. They misrepresented its trade worthiness. And somehow, some of this GMO corn called Viptera made its way across the ocean to China, and the Chinese ultimately retaliated by refusing to accept U.S. corn for the years of 2013 and 2014. Is that correct?
Pretty much. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, well, for those of you who are interested in finding out more, you can head right on over to Story City Pizza Ranch on Monday morning, July 11th at 8:30. Sean and other lawyers will be there presenting the situation and how you can get involved if you feel that you have been impacted by this drop in corn prices.
And if you don't mind, Greta, if people want more information on a digital platform, they can go to our website, MidwestCornLawsuit.com, or if they want to just call, they can call 515-635-1626, and they can talk to a live person, get more information that way.
And that was Sean Fagan, attorney associated with Moore, Archer and Associates and the Midwest Corn Lawsuit. We'll have that contact information on our website, khoifm.org, later in the day. You're listening to Local Talk. I am your host, Greta Anderson. Well, last week brought a series of horrifying videos and news reports from places as distant as Baton Rouge and Minneapolis, where innocent black men were assaulted and killed by police, and Dallas, Texas, where five police officers were killed by snipers during a Black Lives Matter rally. By the end of the week, the nation was focused once again on the tragic and criminal injustice suffered by blacks at the hands of some police and on the debilitating fear that police live with when their relationship with the community breaks down. With us in the studio are guests representing two AIMS organizations that have decided to get proactive, and they decided this several months ago, if not a whole year ago, to ensure that AIMS Iowa did not become sucked into this vortex of race-based violence and fear. We have Edna Clinton, president of the local chapter of the NAACP, and Commander Jeff Huff of the Ames Police. Thank you for being here. We also have Davida Hardin, who is here as a concerned citizen, concerned about maintaining positive racial relations in our midst. Before we get to talk about the work that you've been doing together, let's check in with our guests and how the events of last week affected you. Edna Clinton.
Thank you, Edna. First of all, before I begin, I would like to take a moment of silence to recognize the sadness that this past week has happened around our country for the families, for the shattered communities, for all of the individuals whose lives were relinquished much too soon. Thank you. Well, my emotions all over the chart is the best I can describe them. There's sadness, there's anger, there's the confusion that comes with yet again. There's the total frustration of haven't we gone down this path before? Why repeat history? what we have seen in the last several years is what I refer to as modern-day lynching, except instead of a rope, they are guns. And guns don't kill, people do. So my emotions are just really high right now, some good ones, in terms of the fact that we here in Ames are being proactive as best that we possibly can. And sadness that we still, if you will, have the bad apples in our good barrel of apples.
Thank you. Commander Huff, how did you feel last week when this news broke?
Obviously, it's been a rough week for everybody. You know, these incidents keep playing out. And it builds just a divide between everybody. There's many sides to this. It's not just two sides, but many sides to it. We also don't like to see these kind of incidents happen. I will say I don't know enough about them yet to say for sure exactly what happened. But we get this rush to judgment, and that could be frustrating as well. And then you have this thing in Dallas, which is just heart-wrenching for all police officers and all of their families. So I hope that incidents like this can at least bring us together even more and work on these issues and hopefully create a culture where we don't have these kind of incidents anymore. I think that's everybody's hope, is that we can do away with it.
Cultural change. DeVita.
I echo what Edna said. I feel sad, frustrated, helpless, burdened. I have a son. I have four grandsons, one of which is driving. And I think about them often. The world that our society, as they grow, the fear that they could lose their life over a misunderstanding is makes my heart sad. I feel sad for the families who have to endure this grief that their loved one got up, went about their daily work, but they didn't come home. And through it all, I've listened to many, many conversations through social media and TV, and I hope that we can get past the us versus them, that we can see each other as human beings, that we can have mutual respect and listen to the facts. You know, that's my hope. That's how I'm feeling.
And you have been working toward that goal, the NAACP and the police. In fact, as Commander Huff came into the studio this morning, Edna gave him a big hug, and it was very nice to see that you certainly are understand each other as human beings. Tell us about the work you've been doing.
Well, I have to tell you, first of all, that back in 2012, we reactivated the Ames chapter of the NAACP. After we did that, there were some incidents in the nation. I decided, as the president of the NAACP, I wanted to get a look at what the police officers go through. So I joined the academy, the Citizens Academy, and went through that process. And it became crystal clear to me that the only difference between their lives and my life was the uniform that they put on and the pledge that they will serve and protect me as a citizen. But they are also citizens in the same community. And so I got a whole new healthy respect for what is known as I want to go home. Okay. We as citizens don't oftentimes think about I want to go home. Officers must. They must.
Can you explain a little what you mean by that?
They are the ones that put themselves between us and crime. They never know who they're going to meet. They never know how volatile the situation is going to be. Even when they go into a situation that is on the surface, appear to be very peaceful, can escalate to something else. And I never really thought about their side of things, even though I have police officers in my family, okay? I have to preface all of that. I went back to my board and I said, you know, Ames has not had a Trayvon situation. Ames has not had a New York situation. Ames has not had a Ferguson situation. We need to be proactive. So, I called the police chief and said, we need a meeting. We met with his officers, and I think it was the administrative manager. Is that what he's called?
Yep.
Okay. And we talked about where do we go as a community? What do we do to bridge the gap? And so we came up with this idea of what we call educational dialogue sessions. And then, of course, we had to decide on, okay, what's first? And so we thought, okay, what is the most common thing that all of us may encounter? That's routine traffic stops.
You bet, yep.
That was our first session in 2013 and had a wonderful response. And Lieutenant Huff gave an impeccable demonstration of what happens, how it happens. DeVita served as the citizen, the very angry citizen who got stopped.
Oh, there's some role playing, I see.
Right. We did a role play. It was just absolutely phenomenal because most individuals do not understand why they may get stopped. That's why they're called routine. There could be any number of reasons. And there's special protocol in terms of how the citizen responds to the officer and how the officer responds to the citizen. There are certain things that as officers, because of safety reasons, they like to see your hands in a position that is non-threatening. They take a position outside of your car for their safety. All of these things were exhibited during that routine traffic office session. It was just unbelievable. Jeff did a wonderful job, and so did DeVita. Then we came together and evaluated it and said, okay, what's the next thing that is oftentimes misunderstood by citizens? And so what we are doing is setting the groundwork for citizens to understand the law and to appreciate what the officers are expected to do. And the officers are looking at it from, okay, what can we expect from citizens of color in particular, but citizens, period. Our next session was done on the Miranda Act. If you would ask the average person about the Miranda Act, they would say, oh, you've got to read me my Miranda Act. Mm-hmm. And really, the answer is, no, they don't. Not until you are put in a position and they are going to arrest you for a specific reason. They can take you to jail. They can put you in a retaining cell. They can do all of that without reading you the Miranda Act.
She was paying very close attention.
Yeah,
I
attended that session, and I'm sort of vaguely remembering that.
I have made it a point. If I expect them to understand me, then I need to understand them. And it is my hope and desire that all citizens get to the point where Lieutenant Huff and his staff are not looked at because they have on a blue uniform,
pack a nice size weapon, have a shield on their chest, that they're not there to make your life miserable.
Okay. Commander Huff, tell us about your experience with those sessions.
Well, it's been very good. We've gotten a pretty good response. We had some fun with it as well. We actually recorded them. And I think this, just talking right now, it probably makes sense that we put those back out for the public to look at, because there was a lot of people that obviously couldn't have been there if they had wanted to. So it's probably the good time to break those back out and put them back up. And I'm looking forward to the next session, but Edna's right. I think a lot of times the breakdown comes in some communication and just a misunderstanding about, you know, why the officers are doing certain things. And most of the things that, that officers do on the street, the reason they're doing them is for safety reasons.
For their own safety.
For their own safety. And the safety of the other person.
Anybody.
Like getting out of your car. A lot of people think, well, if I get out of my car and come back to the officer, that'll make their life easier. We don't like that. For a lot of reasons, we want you to stay in your car. One, it's the safest place for you to be, because I don't want you out on the roadway. And two, it's easier for me to see what's going on and kind of contain this, whatever the situation is. And we make a lot of routine traffic stops in Ames. Right. Last month, we wrote 230 tickets or so for the month of June, which actually is not that many when, in the big scheme of things. But we had 100 and some accidents, too, so that's bad. Mm. But so this happens every day. You know, many times a day we stop people. And I think if the general public had a better understanding of why we do conduct a traffic stop the way we do it, there would probably be fewer kind of disagreements. And we don't have a lot of disagreements either. Most people, you know, they're speeding and they run a stop sign. They know they did something wrong. They get pulled over and, you know, they take it. But there are other incidents where there is a misunderstanding. So we need to cut down on that by making sure that our officers are doing a good job of communicating. They're being respectful and they're explaining what they're doing and why they're doing it. And we just expect that from our citizens, too, that they're just as respectful.
Yeah, the business about the hands being visible, that was kind of news to me. Mm-hmm. I guess I heard, you know, keep your hands on the 10 and 2 of the clock of your steering wheel. A lot of these tragic events have happened when I think people are reaching for their documentation and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And there's the police officer who, you know, jumps to the conclusion that they're reaching for a gun or something like that. How do you end up getting your documentation? What's the best way for a citizen to do that while they're holding their right. hands on the steering wheel?
Well, generally, what we like when we walk up is to be able to see your hands and get some eye contact with you. And then we'll start asking for your documents. And we know that you're going to reach for them then, but if we say, hey, I need to see, and pretty much every officer is going to say, I need to see your license, your registration, and your proof of insurance. And I know that you don't carry all those things in your pocket. So there may be something in your glove box. There may be something in your back pocket. There may be something in your purse. So just saying, you know, I'm going, my registration is in the glove box. Fine. And we'll have a good view of that. And that's why you may see the officer really looking inside the vehicle, because we're looking for anything that might hurt us. Because tragically, officers are killed almost every day, at least injured every day, on traffic stop situations. And sometimes it's by the violator, but we've got all these other things that are occurring too, where officers are getting hit by cars while they're conducting traffic stops. So we've got a lot going on that we have to be paying attention to. So the easier you can make it for the officer by just following the instructions, that just helps us out so we don't have to worry so much about everything else too.
And then Edna said that part of these conversations were, and education sessions were, about telling police or, you know, helping police understand what you can expect from citizens of color. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, you know, Edna and the members of the NAACP who attended these sessions kind of got into the police frame of mind and, okay, these are all the dangers that you have to navigate through. What were some of the insights that you gathered from that community about what it's like to be a person of color in that situation?
I think a lot of what we discussed was being clear about why we were doing certain things, so that the people that we encounter, whoever that is, has at least some understanding of why we've made contact with them, whether it's a traffic stop. The big one is letting people know right away why I stopped you. Nobody likes, and this is kind of the old method, and I can explain why we did it, but when you walk up to the vehicle, do you know why I pulled you over today? Now, nobody likes to hear that when they get stopped. Whoever you are, nobody likes to hear that. Well, the reason we do it is because I'd like to get an admission from you. If you say, well, because I was speeding, I'm not going to go to court. Because you just made that admission and we record our traffic stops. And so it just makes our lives easier, right? But the problem is nobody kind of likes that. And it sets the tone for that whole interaction kind of negatively. So we do train our officers now to walk up, introduce yourself, and tell the people right away, the reason I stopped you is because you were speeding or you ran a stop sign or whatever. And in fact, that actually puts people at ease a little bit because they don't have to sit there and kind of guess. And it's been pretty effective. We still have a few officers that from the old school that they still may walk up occasionally and do the, do you know why I pulled you over thing. And there may be, as we explained at the session, there may be some times when we still do that because there may be something else going on. It may not be just a routine traffic stop. Maybe this car was reported in some kind of crime or something else. And so we may want to dig a little bit before maybe we let you know exactly what's going on. But those are kind of the fewer and far between. Most of the time it's a traffic violation. Mm.
Okay. Any comments from you folks? Was that
no? I just want to clarify that our experience here in Ames with our police department, because they do belong to the Ames citizens. You know, we pay the taxes that pay their bills. You know, so yes, we. But it's not a traditional boss-employee relationship.
Of course.
People of color have a history of people in authority treating them in less than a respectful manner. And over the years, it used to be, especially when I was growing up, if you're stopped by the police, keep your mouth shut and don't say anything. And that was the mode that we grew up in. And now, over the years, we've taught our young people, if you have an opinion, voice it. I do find that the area of respect is a little weak. However, I think that we can all learn to respect each other.
I know one thing that President Obama has talked a lot about is community policing, getting to know the community so that there is not that divide of authority versus, you know, person affected by authority or person with a history of bad relations with authority. Has your department, Jeff Huff, taken measures to be more present, more maybe on foot instead of in car or things like that?
Yeah, we call it community engagement. And Edna's right. You pay taxes. You pay our salaries. We understand that. And so to a certain extent, all, you know, like they say, all politics is local. All policing is local, too, because it's, it comes down to what's important to the community. So we try and look at what does the community want? What can we provide? So part of that, yes, is engagement. So a few things that we do. Obviously, the sessions that we've put on with the NAACP, very important. Those are hopefully going to continue for some time. But there's a lot of other times we try and get officers out in the community. So we've got National Night Out coming up in, I don't know the exact date, August. It's
around the 16th.
Yeah, around the middle of August. Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty big event that that we're a part of putting on. Banshell Park, I hope, is where we're going to have it again. We're having some issues with where we're going to have it. But we'll get that going. We're going to hand out the backpacks with all the school supplies. So the kids that need a little extra help as school starts, hopefully we can provide them some school supplies. We do Shop with a Cop every year. So if you – most people, I think, in Ames, we've been doing it for 22, 23 years now. Ever since I actually started, the police department was the first year, 1994, first year Shop with a Cop. So we do that every year, again, helping those that need the help around that time of year. And then just on a daily basis, we're always out in the community. We're giving talks. We give talks at the university. The fraternities and sororities are calling us all the time for those kind of things. So we're, most of our officers live in Ames or around Ames. We're a part of the community. It's not, we don't just police the community. We live here too. And so, you know, we want people to be comfortable with us. We want people to be able to come and talk to us. And we want people, if they feel like they were not treated properly, we want them to contact us. I want to know about it. So if you've had a contact that you didn't care for, and you think the officer was either disrespectful, didn't do their job right, whatever, I want to know about it, and we investigate those complaints. So certainly feel free to give me a call. I'm in charge of the patrol division, so if they're wearing a uniform, they report to me somehow. So let me know about it, and I'll look into it and get back to you.
That sounds very important.
Could I add something to that? I work in the school district, and Officer Schaefer is our SRO, and he is adding another layer to that community engagement. He's there. We talk. I see him interacting with the students and building that relationship of trust, being that resource, not just for when things go wrong, but when things go right. I see him giving out the badges. I see him giving high fives. He check in on students. How you doing? How was your test? All those things bring me a level of comfort. And so when incidents that have happened in our country, I'm very proud to say that's not going on here in Ames. And if I could take what we have here in Ames and spread it out across the country and say, this is the way it should go, guys. This is the way it can go. Edna said respect. I think mutual respect is so important. It's a lost value in our society, and we need to get it back. And hopefully we can get it back, you know, amongst people as these incidents are highlighted. And the missing piece is mutual respect.
On the other hand, the NAACP of the at the state level has drawn a lot of attention to the fact that in Iowa we have among the very worst ratio of police contact and imprisonment of people of color compared to their proportion in our society. And I know that the NAACP and Betty Andrews have been trying to get some legislation regarding documenting race during traffic stops. For instance, are there more traffic stops of people of color, and also trying to introduce body cameras, perhaps, on officers to make sure that relations are respectful on both sides and have documentation of that. What do you think about those measures that the larger NAACP has introduced and the reasons that they have introduced them?
Well, since I'm part of that group that visits with the governor and Chief Justice Katie on these very issues, I think it's an excellent step in the right direction. These things didn't happen overnight. What we are seeing are accumulation of a number of years of behaviors that you just don't wake up in the morning, turn a light on, and those behaviors are gone. We, as a group, are very serious about our fractured justice system. We live in Iowa. We don't want to be number one on the list in this area. Do we want to be leaders in community relationships with our law enforcement? Yes, we do. We want to show this nation that we in Ames, Iowa, we in Iowa can do this, okay, because we have faith in the citizens here. I am very much in favor of these things because in the work that I have done, in the research that I have done, there's no difference in the number of individuals who use or sell illegal drugs than the people of color.
Right.
But yet we have a tradition in Iowa of being much more harsh if you happen to look like me than if you happen to look like Jeff. Okay? That's a fact. There's no getting around it. We as citizens of Iowa, we need to be ashamed of this. We truly do. Because it's an indication that there's a divide, that we think that skin color has a stacking order, and that the darker your skin, the lower on the totem pole you are. And the fact remains that we are more alike than we are different. You know, we want the same things. We want good jobs. We like good steaks if you happen to eat steaks. We want clean water. We want nice neighborhoods. We want good relationships with our law enforcement officers. We want quality education. We want affordable housing. You name it. Each and every one of us desires to have that. And we allow a part of our population to be denied those rights means that we will deny them to anybody. So it's only a matter of time before it permeates the entire country.
Jeff Huff, your comments on racial disparity, on body cameras, on recording race at traffic stops.
Yeah, I think, right, there is a disparity, but we have to keep in mind that it's a criminal justice system. It's not just the police. So it's the police, it's prosecutors, it's the courts. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the discussion. So I just throw it out that it's the entire system that we need to look at, not just one piece of that. You did mention body cameras, and I think that's kind of a hot button issue. So I want to at least address it. We did some testing, and we're looking at them. We're probably going to end up with them. I can assure probably everybody that at some point we'll be wearing them.
The Ames police will be wearing body cameras.
I think the issue with us when we looked at the cameras, we looked at them early on, and no one camera was great. They all had some problems. Either it was battery life or it was durability. And what we've started to find is we thought if we put this decision off for about 6 or 8 months and let the technology catch up, we probably will end up with a camera that will last longer and do better. And so I think that's where we're at now, is we're now going back in and looking at the changes that they've made to the cameras, because we don't want, as being responsible to our taxpayers, we don't want to buy something that breaks right away and we have to continually fix them or buy new ones. But it's coming. The other piece of it is just sort of a reminder to everybody that most of these things are public information, including camera footage. So we'll get a lot of requests for this footage. It's extra time. We're already planning on having to add some staffing, and that's comes at a cost, just to deal with those kind of things. The other example I gave at one of the forums was when we show up at your neighbor's house for some kind of disturbance, there's nothing that stops your nosy neighbor from coming down to the police department the next day and saying, "Hey, I'd like to see the camera footage from why you were at my neighbor's house yesterday." And in most cases, there would be nothing that could stop us from giving that to them. So I just have to tell people that I don't want to say be careful what you wish for, because I think it is the right thing to have cameras on our officers, because I think that does help in some cases make those interactions more respectful on both sides. But there also could be a downside to it, where there's going to be some things out there that people probably aren't going to be very happy about. So
that's interesting.
It would be nice if – I think there needs to be a look at some legislation to better protect people from just us having to release all of this camera footage, because it really doesn't seem very fair to some people that we would have to release it just because somebody wants to know – like I said, the nosy neighbor wants to know why we were at your house the other day. So I hope that they look at that.
Okay. And the final topic of traffic stops and recording race of of traffic stops.
Race is actually recorded on all of our stops. So we actually have an electronic citation that we fill out, and a part of that citation from the DOT is obviously race and gender and all kinds of stuff that's on there. So it is recorded. The thing that's probably not recorded as well is a traffic stop that doesn't result in any kind of paperwork. So if I stop and give you a verbal warning and that's it, then maybe it wasn't recorded. However, we do a card, a call card, a call for service card on everything we do. So if we make a traffic stop, even if it's only a verbal warning, it should be recorded on that card, the license plate that was stopped, you know, the owner of the vehicle and the driver of the vehicle. So in some form, Those things are recorded. How easy it is to obtain all that information and put it back together sometimes could be more difficult. But in instances where there's a citation or a warning, those are pretty easy to pull. It's the other ones that are a little tougher.
Okay. We're talking with Commander Jeff Huff of the Ames Police and Edna Clinton and Davida Harden of NAACP about some of their cooperative activities and education sessions. Do you have one coming up?
Yes. The summer, a lot of us are, you know, scattered here and there, and things happen, you know. So we felt that it would not be a good time to do it before the students got back in town, because we do live in a college town. They do make up quite a sizable portion of our population. And so whatever we do, we always like to make sure that they have access to as well, you know, not just our citizens. We have not defined explicitly the topic for the next one, but in view of what has happened in our country in recent days, we might change that around. We have not met to discuss it, but we will have one coming up in either late August or early September.
Okay. That's something to look out for. And
yes. I can tell you also that they are always in the evenings, because we realize that people have jobs and work, and so we try to make them at a time where it might be more feasible for them to get to them.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. I'm sure people out there are fairly encouraged to hear about the work that you've initiated, Edna.
Thank you.
And your participation as well, both of you. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have just a little bit of news from the Story County Board of Supervisors correspondent, Leanne Harder. She wants us to know that their meetings, the Board of Supervisors meetings, are now on YouTube. If you go to YouTube, you can go look up Story County, Iowa, and you can see the meetings, which are typically on Tuesdays. So if you can't make the meeting on a Tuesday morning, you can go to YouTube and catch those meetings. Also, some news about the Board of Supervisors. We do now have a Democratic nominee for the position that was left by the untimely death of Paul Toot. So Linda Merkin of Gilbert will be the Story County Democratic candidate, and she'll be running against Martin Chitty, who is now just occupying that seat in the interim. So two seats are up for grabs, including that of your husband, Wayne Clinton.
Yes.
All right. Well, you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. Thanks for joining us today. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Today, we took a look at the Midwest Corn lawsuit against Syngenta. Sean Fagan, a lawyer from Indiana working with the law firm Morrow Archer and Associates, spoke with me earlier last week, and we heard that he will be at the Story City Pizza Ranch talking to farmers and others affected by a drop in prices due to China's boycott of U.S. corn in 2013 and 2014. And then we welcomed Commander Jeff Huff of the Ames Police and local NAACP leaders Edna Clinton and Davida Harden, a concerned citizen, also works at the school. As she told us, Local Talk is on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about the people you heard today on the show and contact information, links to the places things we talked about. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeese. Thank you, Jonah. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team of volunteer reporters. If you would like to join the team, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.